Hey, Bruiser Buddies, this is Wrestling Nostalgia with Dave Dynasty.
Before we dive into the episode, make sure you hit subscribe on the podcast platform you're listening on. Also, follow me on X at The Dave Dynasty and subscribe on YouTube by looking up Nostalgic Dave Dynasty. You can also buy one of my shirts at ProWrestlingTees.com/TheDaveDynasty. Now, enjoy the show.
Welcome to 1 hour of the toughest, roughest wrestling you'll ever see.
That's right, Dick the Bruiser, set it off.
The big question, have you got the endurance? Have you got the brain to get past the excellence of execution?
Does they think they got the answers? I change the questions.
This is Jim Cornette, and the views that I'm about to express are not necessarily those of anybody else but me, but they ought to be, and as a matter of fact, they probably are.
The reason why Ax and myself were put on this earth is to demolish people.
Bobby Heenan, that is a very good-looking sport coat you've got on.
Yeah, and I paid for mine. Mine is in government issue.
Yellow. Everybody, Lance Russell and Dave Brown right along ringside. By golly, we're ready to go with another big week of championship wrestling.
Greetings, wrestling fans, and welcome to Wrestling Nostalgia. I'm your host, Dave Dynasty. Thank you for joining me for yet another episode. On this episode, my guest is Davey O'Hannon. We're going to talk about working for the WWF, Bruno Sammartino, Andre the Giant, and much, much more. So let's take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll have my interview with Davey O'Hannon.
If you like horror movies, be sure to check out Dave Dynasty and Ike Isaacs on the Listen to Their Screams horror podcast. It is available on all podcast platforms and on social media at Listen to Screams. That is Listen, the number two, and Screams.
And welcome back to Wrestling Nostalgia. This time I'm being joined by Davey O'Hannon. Davey, how are you?
I'm doing fine. How are you?
I am very good. Glad to be talking. It's storming here, so hopefully, Davey, we don't lose power. We've had to reschedule this thing a few times, but hopefully we can get this in.
Yeah.
Yeah. Talk to me. You grew up a big fan of pro wrestling. So tell us about when you first discovered wrestling.
When I, as a fan, yeah, I was 6 or 7 years old. When do you get measles when you're a little kid? I was home from school with measles, and I happened to see wrestling on television. And I said, gee, that's interesting. And I took a look. Now, my family has been in the newspaper and magazine business forever, both sides of my family. And as a professional courtesy, when one of the delivery trucks would go by your house, if they were in a neighborhood, and it was magazines or comic books or whatever newspapers, they would toss you a bundle of stuff. Well, I happened to get a Ring Boxing magazine in that bundle. And Ring Boxing, years ago, back in the 60s, probably the 50s also, used to devote a couple of pages in the back to wrestling. Yeah. And I said, well, wait a minute. These look like the guys I saw on television. And from there, I became a fan. And, soon after that, I said to myself, I want to be a professional wrestler when I grow up. So it was a dream come true. You know, that's all I ever wanted to do. I wrestled in school. I wrestled in high school and college. But my focus was always to do this. I used to bug the promoters all the time. When I got to go to a show.
Let's talk about it. You grew up, you were in the Northeast United States. So,
yeah,
so
New
that's
Jersey.
Obviously. Yeah. So that's obviously WWF territory. And you're obviously, and we'll talk about it more, but you're obviously a huge fan of Bruno Sammartino. We'll dive into that. But you told the story before that you were in Madison Square Garden when Bruno won the title from Buddy Rogers in 63.
Yeah, I sure was. Since the newspaper business had the people working in it working at night, It was my mom that took me to Madison Square Garden. You know, back when you could, we walked from the Port Authority, took the bus from New Jersey, got to the Port Authority in New York, and walked up 8th Avenue to the old garden. And there it was. You know, it was a magical kind of place. It was unbelievable. And, I got to see my idol. I lived and died with Bruno as a fan. But part of the dream that came true was, Bruno and I turned out to be really close personal friends.
That's right.
Yeah. What? Yeah. And, he was one of the guys that kind of babysat me when I was in the business.
So tell me, as a fan, what was it about Bruno, right? What was it that hooked you about Bruno Sammartino?
It's not like the fans now. And I never, even when I was in the business, referred to the fans as marks. I just I just didn't do that. The guys in my era, we would call them the people. That's what we'd say, the people. But, what appealed to Bruno for me, and I guess everybody else, was just he was such a honest guy in the ring. You know, you didn't see him come in there with all kinds of nonsense. Maybe once in a while he'd have a towel around his neck, but that was it. And he was just a regular kind of guy. He was just a regular kind of guy. And don't forget, the New York territory back then was a huge ethnic territory. And if you went to the garden, it was nuts. If you went to the garden, you'd hear the people cheering in Italian for Bruno. So it was, he was just the, what you see is what you got from Bruno. And, he was honest all the way through. He was like that outside the ring as a regular everyday person. He was just such a fine individual that it was a pleasure to be around. And for me, it was a thrill. The wrestling magazines, we used to call them the after magazines, but the wrestling magazines used to have a centerfold pinup in color. And since I was a big fan, I had all these magazines, and I had from like 1963, I'm sure, because it had the belt on them, and I had one before that, so one without the belt. Anyway, Bruno and I were on the road one night, and I said to him, "Hey, Bruno, I said I got to ask you a question. I said I got a couple of these foldouts from the magazine. I said, would you mind if I brought them next time we traveled and you autographed them for me?" He said, "You think you have to ask me that question?" He said, "What's wrong with you?" And I'm, my name is O'Hanlon, but I'm half Italian. And he used to remind me, he says, "Oh, Christ, the only good half of you is that Caruso side where your mother's on."
That's one of the things, right? The WWF did so well was play, because there was those in New York, right? There was those areas that were ethnic, right? So had Bruno for the Italians, you had Pedro for they knew that they needed that, right? To draw those fans in.
Oh yeah. Well, Vince McMahon Sr. was a genius.
Absolutely.
He kind of inherited it from his dad, but we always said that, first of all, if you put a broomstick in the ring with Bruno, it drew, you'd sell it out. So that's not a problem. But there was such an immense population in the New York, New Jersey, Connecticut area that you really never had to worry about, drawing a house. And that was the down after I got in the business. I appreciated it because the New York territory, they would let anybody get in the ring that showed up with a pair of tights and boots, but not in the house shows, not in the house shows for TV. And I'm sure you saw it. If you look back, you'll see guys, and I won't mention their names because I won't, I know my place in the wrestling business. I'm a nobody compared to a whole bunch of people. But there were people that they let do TV in New York that were there for one reason and one reason only, to get squashed.
Yeah.
They got murdered. No offense. Don't even pick your hands up. Don't try it. I mean, it was nuts, you know, and I can say that, you know, I never let that happen to me. But, you know, the promotion knew what they had with a guy. You know, when I was already an athlete when I bullshitted my way into the business. You know, there were no schools back then.
Sure. We're going to talk about that.
there were no schools. You had to get somebody that trusted you and wanted you to be in to train you.
Yeah.
And, you know, I never got that.
Yep,
I never got that because I never asked someone to do it because I didn't know how to get into the business.
Yep.
You know, I had my first few matches. I wasn't even smart.
Yeah.
I wasn't even smart to the business. And that, let me tell you, that's dangerous.
Definitely. Well, before we close the book on Bruno, let's talk. And I know this is, we're kind of skipping ahead and then we'll come back. But you're such a fan of Bruno that you actually helped kind of write the definitive book on Bruno in 2019. So tell us about that. You know, we'll come back. We're going to go back to your career, but tell us about how that book project happened.
Well,
for you to write a book on Bruno.
Well, I didn't write the book. That was a fellow named Sal Corrente, the book.
Yeah.
He, you know, I worked with him a whole lot on it. You know, now keep in mind what a fan I was of Bruno. You know, my wife used to say, sometimes a phone would ring and say, I say, listen, you know, I don't want to talk to anybody. She'd say, well, what if it was Bruno? Oh, okay. Well, that's different. You know, I'll talk
sure,
to Bruno.
Yeah.
But, you know, so Sal was doing a book and he said, do you mind if I kind of consult with you? I said, yeah, you could ask me anything you want to. And the funny part was, he called me one day and he said, you know, we're getting ready to wrap this up and I got to ask permission on something. I said, what? He said, do you mind if I put a couple of pictures of you? And I said, wait a minute. You're asking, do I mind if you put my picture in a book about Bruno Sammartino? Mm-hmm. He said, well, yeah, I got to ask you. I said, well, now I can die happy. I said, yeah, you can. You go right ahead. Go right ahead. But, sure. You know, we were that close. I talked to Bruno, all through from the time I knew him, you know, until very, very near the day he passed away. It was, it was a really, really sad day for me. You know, and, you know, we went out to the service in Pittsburgh and, you know, he was the kind of guy that you just never thought would go away.
Right. Yeah. And you talked about, right, you talked about being a fan and that you watched it early on and you just knew this is what you wanted to do.
And there was no doubt.
Well, so much so that you, like you said, you pretty much just started bugging promoters. And they ultimately told you to finish college, but you were a little persistent guy, weren't you?
Well, yeah. They all would say to you, go finish college, kid. Come back and talk to me.
Yeah.
Okay. So even earlier than that, now, I don't know if you're familiar with the New Jersey, New York area.
Mm-hmm.
There's an arena called the Asbury Park Convention Hall. It's it's right on the beach in Asbury Park, New Jersey.
Yep. Right.
Short town. It's a great, great arena. Or was, mm-hmm. anyway. Anyway, as a kid, and I think it was probably 1964, so I was, 13 years old. So at that point, you know, and at that time, you know, your parents could let you go do something without them monitoring you. So, so my mom and my aunt would take my cousin and I down to Asbury Park. It was about 35 miles south of where we lived. And they would go to the movies up at the one end of the boardwalk, and my cousin and I would go to the wrestling matches. And as we were leaving, right across the street from the convention hall, there's two buildings. One is called the Stone Pony that Springsteen plays in every once in a while. And yeah, there's another, and the other place is a like a bar and grill and everything, outside stand, benches to sit on. And as we're walking out, my mother, my aunt, my cousin, and I, George Steele is sitting at the counter. It's outside. It's on the street, and he's having a steak sandwich and a beer. Mm-hmm. And my mother says, "Isn't that one of the wrestlers?" I said, "Oh my God, that's George the Animal Steele." I don't know if it was the animal then, but it was sure. George Steele.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh my God, you know. So my aunt walks up to George and says, "Excuse me, my nephew wants to be a wrestler." So George says, "Who's your nephew?" So there I am standing there. And he says, "Come here, you. Come here." And by the way, George and I were also very close personal friends. You know, my kids, my wife, they all, you know. And I step a little closer to him, and he says to my mother, "Listen, there's a little green and white splash up north called Michigan State. You send him up there, and if he finishes up there and still wants to be a wrestler, you get a hold of me. And if he gives you any trouble, you come to me, and I'll put my foot right up his ass." I went, "Whoa, look at this. This is George Steele talking to me."
Okay, sure.
Now, I never collected autographs as a kid. So that night, before we saw George, there was a guy named Miguel Perez, who was a superstar in New York at the time. And he was sitting there. So I got his autograph, the one and only autograph, beside Bruno's, eventually when I was in the business, that I ever got. Anyway, so here's George Steele. He was the first one I probably said it to. And then I would go to the matches. Once I got my driver's license and I could get around, I'd go to the matches. I'd knock on a dressing room door. I would tell Arnold Skolan, I would tell Monsoon, whoever, that I want to do this. And Skolan said to me once, actually in the Asbury Park Convention Hall, he said, tell you what, kid, go to college. When you're done, come back here and see me. I said, okay, that's what I'll do. I went out to school in Missouri. So I found out what was going on out there. You know, I was never exposed to the NWA stuff. Because I grew up in New Jersey. We didn't have that.
Right.
So I went out and I was in school in Missouri and we get on the bus at school up to Kansas City and watch the matches.
Yeah.
So I got an idea one day and I kind of figured out who was running the show and took the bus up to the Kansas City Memorial Auditorium, which they used to run on Thursday nights, was their big show. Uh-huh. And I got there at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I had a suitcase with me, really didn't have anything in it. You know, I had my school wrestling shoes, my singlet and probably a towel. I banged on the back door of the arena and the guy opened the door and said, "What? Oh, are you a wrestler?" I said, "Yep."
Sure.
Well, I wasn't lying. I was a wrestler.
That's right. Yeah.
I just wasn't a professional wrestler.
Wow. He said, right?
Yeah. So he said, "Come on in, I'll show you where the dressing room is." Okay. Oh, now what am I going to do? So he sits me down. You know, like I said, it's 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon. These guys don't get here till 7 o'clock at night.
Yeah.
So I sat there and I sat there and I sat there and then I heard footsteps and the first two guys that walked in were Dusty Rhodes and Dick Murdoch. They were working as the Outlaws.
The Outlaws, yeah.
And they walked in. You know, now don't forget, I had no idea of how things worked. They walked in, they introduced themselves, went about their business, went to their other dressing room, And I'm sitting there and I hear other steps, and it's the promoter. It's Bob Geigel and a guy named Gus Karras. And as soon as they came in, Bob Geigel says to me, "Who are you and what are you doing here?" So I said, "Oh, time to think fast." I said, "Arnold Skolan sent me to see you, and he said you could get me some work." And he looked at me and he said, "You know Skolan?" I said, "Well, yeah, I'm from New Jersey, you know, and I saw him in New York out there." He said, "Okay, sit tight. We'll talk to you in a little while." So I watched the matches. Now, don't forget, I was in school. I don't think I had $2 to my name once I got up there. And Bob Geigel says, "Well, where are you staying tonight?" "I don't know. Come with me." Puts me in a car. Lady wrestler named Betty Nicolai was there. And drove us. The Kansas City War Memorial is in the Kansas side of Kansas City. Drove us back into Kansas City, Missouri, to the hotel that all the wrestlers stayed at. And he said, "Well, you stay here for tonight, and we'll have breakfast in the morning, and then I'll talk to you." Okay. I didn't want to say to him, "Well, does it cost any money to stay here?"
So, right.
so he says, "Wait a minute." So he walks over to the desk. You know, it's an old, the name was the Senator Hotel. You know, an old place. It was 100 years
old.
So we walk in there, and he says to the guy at the desk, "I need a room for my friend here. How much is that?" So the guy says, $7. $7? "Yeah, what are you, robbing him? You don't have $7. We're not paying you $7 for this room." So by the time he turned around, it was $3. So I, well, shit, that's great. You know, I'm counting my money to make sure I have bus fare to go back. So I had my room, and I honestly don't remember paying for it, whether I did or not. But so I stayed in a room downstairs in the morning. I meet Bob Geigel at this little cafe next to the Senator Hotel. And he says to me, "So Skolan sent you down?" I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "Okay, tell you what." He says, "Be in Sedalia, Missouri, Tuesday night." He says, "Get there around 6:30, 7 o'clock, and you'll be all right." And that's what I did. I went to Sedalia, Missouri. No idea of how this business worked. None whatsoever. I worked with a guy named Joe Scarpello. Joe Scarpello was a two-time AAU champ, NCAA champ. He was a World War II hero on a bomber. I don't know if he was a pilot or not, but he was there. And the guy was, you know, he wasn't a big guy. Now, I was playing football at the time, so I was, you know, almost 6 feet, 260 pounds. Joe Scarpello was maybe 5'9". You know, 210, 215. So I'm sitting in the dressing room, and it's, you know, a fellow named Ronnie Etchison, who was another old timer that I watched wrestle. I actually watched him wrestle Angelo Savoldi in the Asbury Park Convention Hall. So, he's evidently the agent, which I didn't know existed, for the Kansas City office. And he says, "Okay, kid, you guys are on now." So I get up. But in the dressing room, I heard guys talking. And I heard the word "shoot." Okay, I know what "shoot" means. I'm an amateur. So I know what that is. And I heard "work." And I heard "work." I didn't know what that was. So we get in the ring. Ronnie Etchison's refereeing also. And I said, "What are we doing? Are we shooting or are we working?" And Ronnie Etchison, he had a voice that sounded like he had an ice skate stuck in his throat. And he says, "Oh, Christ, here we go." Well, I still don't know what I said that was wrong or right, but Joe Scarpello looks at me and says, "Just take your best hold, kid." Okay.
Yeah.
So for the next 7 minutes, I realized that I did not have a best hold.
Sure. Yeah.
I had no idea what just happened to me. Now, Joe Scarpello was a really, really nice guy.
Yeah.
He let me know that he could have hurt me.
Sure.
But he didn't. He didn't. Yeah. And boom, 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 we got done. And I'm sitting in the dressing room on a bench. Got my face in my hands and my head hanging down. And Joe Scarpello walks by behind me and gives me a little slap on the back of the neck and says, "See you tomorrow, kid." And a little voice in my head said, "Eh, maybe not. Eh, maybe not." This sure. wasn't exactly what I saw on television.
Yep.
So a little while later, Ronnie Etchison says, "Kid Geigel says if you want to do it again, Friday night up in St. Joe, and Saturday in Waterloo." St. Joe was where we did, or where they did, Kansas City TV.
Okay.
So I go up there, and I'm sitting in the dressing room.
Mm-hmm.
Still, I came up with a pair of black boxing shoes,
okay,
and my college tights. So uh-huh. that's all I had.
Uh-huh.
And Geigel says, "So you came back, huh?" I said, "Yes, sir." You know, I was very, very respectful and polite. I said, mm-hmm. "Yes, sir." And he said, "Well, you got an easy one tonight." He says, "Don't worry, the guy will lead you through it." I
sure.
said, "Okay." He says, "His name is Lou. He's mm-hmm. right over there." Well, holy shit.
Oh, I didn't, no.
Yeah, Lou says... And I didn't realize what kind of danger I was in at the time because I just watched wrestling on television, you know,
right.
or I went to a match. So a few minutes later, he comes over and I stood up. I introduced myself. He says, "Hey, kid," with a little snicker, "I heard you're a shooter." Oh, boy. Oh. I know I better answer this one right.
Yeah.
I said, "Mr. Thez," I said, "well, you know, I know how to wrestle. You know, I know how to wrestle." So I don't know if you ever watched Lou Thez, you know, and later mm-hmm. I got to be friends with him. So I got to see him a lot. But he said, "Listen, kid, while we're in there," he said, "I might back you up," which means he's going to back me up into the ropes or the corner.
Okay.
And he says, "I might back you up." He says, "And I might slap you in the face." Well, you know, I was an athlete for a long time,
yeah.
and
sure.
One thing that you don't let happen, no matter who it is let yourself get slapped in the face.
Okay.
Unless you're working, and I was a heel. I used to call it and let the baby face do that all the time. But he said, "I might slap you in the face." I said, "Well, Mr. Thez, if you slap me in the face, I'm going to slap you right back."
Oh.
And he just smirked. He just smirked and he walked away. So he did not slap me in the face and he didn't hook me. He didn't hook me, but he did a few things. You know, Lou was really big on putting his elbow on your ear and hitting his fist. Oh,
yeah.
That was a biggie. You know, and I already had a cauliflower ear fixed when I was in high school.
Yeah.
So I knew it was coming. Okay. So Davey, don't be too stupid. Protect yourself with this stuff. You know.
Yeah.
Or you know, I don't know if you ever did it to yourself or somebody ever did it. You know, stick a finger in your belly button and push. We'll see how that feels. Oh
sure.
my God. Or up under your armpit. It's
right.
unbelievable. So he
it's
showed
nerve.
Me a few of those things, but he didn't. You know, he didn't hurt me. He didn't hurt me. And a little later, he walked by me in the dressing room. He said, "You'll be all right, kid." Okay. I think that's a compliment. So that was Friday night. Then I went to Waterloo, and I had my third ever visit inside of a wrestling ring. And the guy's name was Danny something.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, supposedly a good amateur, but I showed him. Danny Hodge.
Yeah.
Danny Hodge.
Yeah.
Jeez. Well, I knew who Danny Hodge was. I was an amateur wrestler. You know.
Right, of course, yeah.
Yeah, I know what the Hodge Trophy is. That's the Heisman Trophy for wrestlers. So I knew that. You know, so Danny Hodge and I just wrestled. Wrestled. And a couple of times he said, take over, but I didn't know what he meant.
Yeah.
I didn't know what he meant. So we wrestled. We had a good, we had a good, solid match. The people probably didn't like it, because Danny's a babyface. And, you know, I was supposed to be a heel, except I didn't know what a heel was.
Sure.
I didn't know what the terminology meant. I had no idea. When I was wrestling with these guys, and I don't know if you're aware, you probably are, but if you look, we work on the left side of the body.
Absolutely, yeah.
Never grab the right arm or right leg. And I'm sure I was doing that because I had no idea. Mm-hmm. And back then, those guys did not smarten you up right away. They didn't smarten you up, you know, for a number of reasons. You know, they want to see if you're serious about it. They want to see if you're respectful to their business. And some guys just didn't want new guys in there. And, you know, I was big. You know, I was big and strong. And you know, I guess when you're doing that for business, you're thinking to yourself, well, this guy could take my spot.
Yeah,
you know, and I don't know if that was going on because I was certainly not impressive enough to take anybody's spot. But, you know, so I had on-the-job training.
Yeah.
That's how I learned. And when it was time to go home for, I don't know if it was a spring break or a Thanksgiving break or something like that, Geigel said to me, well, where do you live? I said, Jersey. He says, how are you getting home? I said, well, we're driving. He said, do you want to work a shot on the way home? I said, well, yeah. So he called a promoter in Ohio, and I worked the tag team match in Columbus. I think it was Columbus, against a tag team of Frank Valois and Frank Hickey.
Mm-hmm.
And Frank Hickey was one of the best characters ever in the wrestling business. He was
Spaceman, right?
Yep, he was unbelievable. He was unbelievable. You know, he looked like a little fat guy. Let me tell you, man, could he go? He was unreal. And another guy with a serious history, Frank Hickey, was one of Patton's tank guys. You know, he was at the Bulge. He did all of this stuff. But, you know, the guys in the business used to call him Mother Hickey. He had a squeaky voice. He was a funny guy. He was a character. You know, he was from the Carney. He was from the Carney time of the wrestling business.
Yeah.
So, you know, I worked with them and, you know, eventually worked my way back to New Jersey. I got home for break and there was a show in Elizabeth, New Jersey. And I went up to Skoland and I said, hi, Arnold. I said, I went to college, like you said, and Bob Geigel said you could help me out. He went, what? You know Geigel? I said, yeah, I work for him out in Kansas City. He says, you're in? I said, I'm in. I'm still not smart. I didn't tell him that.
Yeah.
So he says, okay, be at Philadelphia TV Tuesday night. Okay. So there I was down in Philadelphia for New York TV, you know, WWWF.
Uh-huh.
And Skoland says to me, are you a baby or a heel? I said, a what? He says, you're a heel tonight. That's what you are.
All right.
Okay. I guess that's a bad guy. I figured that out. And Tony Garea's first match in the territory was with me.
Yeah. Right.
And I worked with Tony, and I grabbed Tony on the wrong side several times. But Tony was such a nice guy, he never said anything to me. And a little later that night, there used to be a spot in the old Philadelphia Arena where you could go around the back and up in the stands, sit and watch the matches. So I used to watch so I could learn.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm watching, and sitting behind me was Don Jardine. Spoiler.
Okay. Spoiler,
Taps me on the shoulder. He says, hey, kid. I said, oh, yeah, what's up? He says, I see you work European style sometimes. You grab them on the wrong side. And I went, oh, wait a minute. Let me pay attention. I paid attention. I went and got a magazine out of the dressing room. I said, oh, it's all on the left side. That's how I got smart to that. So my learning curve was every single night in the ring. Don't try to do too much. Listen to the old timers. And if the guys thought you were sincere about the business and respectful of it, then they taught you. They would say, you know, and I became one of those guys. You'd walk up to somebody and say, hey, listen, I saw your work. Would you mind a little constructive criticism? Mm-hmm. And, you know, if somebody was smart, they said, well, yeah, please. And, you know, they take you where there was nobody, you know, go walk into the empty shower or another room or something. And, you know, geez, I saw you throwing the punches and your punches really look bad. Why don't you try this?
Yeah.
Or why don't you try that? Or do this or do that? And that's exactly how I learned.
Yeah. Well, and you're back in the Northeast. You ended up, right, working regularly in Madison Square Garden. That, I mean, that had to be a dream for you, right? Because you're back
home.
Yeah,
it was really something else. It was really, I mean, just to be in a wrestling ring for me was a big deal.
Sure.
But Madison Square Garden, you know, it was, you know, because there were guys that were superstars in this business back then that never got to work in the Garden.
Yeah.
You know, and if you'd go to other territories, which I eventually did, you know, you'd introduce yourself and somebody would say, hey, did you ever work in the Garden? You know, I'm really friendly with the guy named Irish Mickey Doyle. He's in Detroit. He was fantastic in the business.
Yeah.
You know, he was one of the California hippies and, you know, a couple other gimmicks. But he said to me, geez, I regret never being able to work in the Garden. It was a really special place. It was a really special place.
Yeah. Before we get too deep in that, let's talk about in 76, you toured Japan for the first time for All Japan.
Yep.
What was that like going over there? What was the difference for you? Was it a culture shock for you? Noting the difference between American and Japanese fans.
Well, the Japanese fans don't go, well, maybe they do now. I don't know, but they are not as wild as the fans in the States. Back then, if you took a big bump, you know, by 76, I was flying all over the place and doing my heel stuff. They would sometimes laugh or giggle. Sometimes they'd clap, but it really wasn't. It wasn't the crazy, you know, boisterous. You know, I love the heel. Or I love the baby face and I hate the heel stuff. It was kind of reserved. Now, when I first went, I had not planned on going to Japan. I was actually working in the White Plains County Center in New York. And I had just gotten a contract handed to me that night by some guy from India. And he said to me, you know, just take a look at this. I want you to come over. Now, we're talking like 76, 75 or 76, and he said, you know, I'm ready to give you $8,000 a week and all your expenses. Okay, just let me find my pen, you know. Let me see where I sign this. So I sit down and, you know, I was sitting next to Bruno, and he says, what's going on? I says, hey, man, Bruno, I said, I'm going to India. He said, you're doing what? I said, I'm going to India. He said, for who? I said, I don't know. I don't know the guy's name. Just gave me this contract. He says, give me that. So he looks at the contract. He hands it back to me. He says, tear that up. Bruno, he said, $8,000 a week. He said, yeah. Did he tell you the part that the money you make in India, you have to spend there? You can't bring it back? I went, no. He said, tear that up. He said, you'll go to Japan. I said, I will. He said, call me at home in the morning, he said, and I'll talk to you. So I just said to the guy, I said, ah, you know what? I messed up my bookings. I didn't realize when I had free. I'll get back to you on it. I didn't want to, you know, be disrespectful to him. So I called Bruno in the morning. He said, okay. He said, yeah, you're going to go to Japan for 5 weeks. So I said, well, first of all, Bruno, I got to ask you, am I qualified to even work there? Am I good enough to work? He said, I wouldn't send you if you weren't. Good enough for me. You know, Bruno's word was gold. So, at that point in my life, I haven't traveled a whole lot. I asked somebody, you know, what's the weather like in Japan? Same seasons as New Jersey has, except they didn't tell me they get 500 feet of snow up in the mountains. So I go, you know, and I'm packing like I'm going for 5 weeks. You know, some guys carry a little travel bag and that's it. I'm saying, well, shit, you know, I like my clothes clean every day. You know, I'm really fussy about that stuff. You know, I'm kind of picky. I'm, you know, Mike Sharp and I used to be the last two out of the arena taking showers. So I'm a little picky about that. So Bruno says, nah, not a problem. And, you know, I flew out to, they called me a day later from Japan. A fellow's name was Joe Higuchi, who was the referee and Baba's right-hand man. And got me all set up. They sent me the contracts. They sent me the working visas, you know, everything that I needed. And they brought me out to L.A. I worked one night for Mike LaBelle in some town out there. I don't know where. Got on a plane, went to Japan, and so that was my first trip. Now, the guys in the workers were pretty much Americanized, but they were a little bit stiffer than we were. So that's okay. You know, I can do that too. I can do that because they really liked it when you laid it in, and except for Baba. You know, Baba was, you know, I was already smart enough to know he was the boss. And his partner was a guy named Sakaguchi, who was a big, he was almost 7 feet tall, over 300 pounds. You know, Baba was probably 7 feet tall and 130 pounds, but Sakaguchi was big and clumsy. But I knew they were partners in the business. So I said to myself, all right, well, if I'm taking bumps, it's these two guys I'm taking them for, you know.
Sure.
And Baba would work with you, you know, and keep in mind, I hated Baba the Giant when he wrestled Bruno, you know, when I was a kid.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'll never forget him sneaking up behind Bruno when Ray Morgan was doing the interview and putting the Japanese sleeper him, and Bruno, as he fell to the floor, went, "Remember Pearl Harbor," or something like that, you know. So I mean, so now not only am I friends with Bruno, but I'm working, you know, for Baba the Giant, and you know, so that was another piece of my story that was kind of surreal to me. And, you know, we got in a ring, and Baba was as light as a feather to work with. But Sakaguchi, at one point, I went up to the top turnbuckle to drop a knee or an elbow, but I told him, slam me off the top.
Uh-huh.
Well, he really liked that. So for the next 3.5 weeks, every single night, off the top rope, splat, boom, bang. You know, some of the rings were good and some of the rings were bad. And a couple of times Sakaguchi was so clumsy, when he reached up to get me to slam me, he cracked me on the jaw, knocked me off backwards, you know, all kinds of stuff. So that was kind of fun. And Joe Higuchi came into the dressing room one night and said, Davey, Baba-san wants to see you in the office right now. I said, oh, shit.
Yeah.
What did I do? Now, on that tour, it was myself, Mark Lewin, King Curtis, Dick Murdoch, and Wahoo McDaniel. Okay. And I was kind of hanging out with these guys.
Yeah.
Well, let me tell you, I learned after 2 weeks I can't hang out with them because I probably wouldn't live. But
yeah.
So I'm saying to myself on the way to the office, oh, crap. Because, you know, the contracts were very specific. If you misbehaved in public, if you weren't dressed properly, they would stop and send you home.
Yeah.
They would send you home. They were really, you know, wrestling, sumo wrestling was their national sport at the time.
Yeah.
And so wrestling, you know, was pretty big over there. So I said, oh, crap, what did I do now? So I went over. I had a guarantee of $1,200 a week plus all expenses. All right. You know, I was a single guy, and, you know, I would have gone anywhere to wrestle. So he calls me in the office. He's got my contract there. I had already asked Joe Higuchi, how do I show respect? You know, there's different ways to bow for the Japanese people. A deep bow is the highest form of respect. You know, a quick nod your head bow is just an acknowledgement. So, you know, I kind of prepared myself, and he had my contract on the desk, and I saw it. I went, oh, shit. And he picked it up, and he tore it in half, and I went, oh, not for me, because I knew I had a round-trip plane ticket, but Bruno sent me there. Bruno was a close friend with Baba.
Yeah.
And I went, oh, my God. And he gave me an $800 a week raise. He raised it. Yeah, he raised it to $2,000 a week. You know, and we got paid in American dollars. They paid the tax in Japan. They paid the 20% tax. So if you went for $2,000 a week and you went for 5 weeks, you had $10,000, unless you spent some on, you know, while you were there. So we did that, you know, because they paid all your expenses. So, you know, somebody smart came home with a lot of money.
Yeah. Right.
Somebody like me didn't. But anyway, so, you know, he said, I like your work. He said, we'll see you again. I said, okay. Well, thank you very much. Domo arigato.
Yeah.
You know, and that was that.
Deep bow, right? Deep bow.
I think he got a couple of them, you know.
Sure.
He got a couple of them. So that was, you know, that's another little chapter for me. It was such a big treat.
Yeah, of course.
You know, here's Bruno setting me up to go work in Japan. And also on that trip, like I said, was King Curtis. I watched King Curtis somewhere in my house. I have the little snapshots from my Brownie camera of Bruno working with King Curtis.
as a fan.
And Mark Lewin. Mark Lewin and Don Curtis were a big tag team for the New York territory. You know, so these guys, this was Wahoo McDaniel. I was also a football fan. I remember being in Shea Stadium when they would announce tackle made by number 54, guess who? The whole place would go, Wahoo! You know, so here I am on the road with Wahoo McDaniel.
Yeah.
So you know, when I complain about things, my wife will say, look what you got to do. You got to live your dream. A lot of people don't. And that's true. You know, that's legitimate to say that.
Sure. So tell us, in 1979, there was an issue when David Von Erich made his only Madison Square Garden appearance. And you didn't want to put him over, right? So
yeah. Another one of my great moves in the wrestling business. Yeah.
Well, I mean, so tell us about this. Because it's right. It's you. Because this is David's only appearance there, right? He's not a New York guy. He's not a New York regular.
That's right. Yeah. Well, I had already been to Texas, and I was in the Amarillo territory.
Yeah.
But once in a while, we'd have to go down. You know, they'd swap talent once in a while. We'd go down and work, you know, in Dallas or Houston or wherever. So, you know, how many times do you think I saw Claw when I was in Texas? The answer is plenty of times.
Yeah, anyway. Which we should mention, right? In Texas, you held the brass knuckles title. You were a guy in Texas.
Yeah. So here I am. So I come back to New York, and, you know, it used to be a big book they kept all your bookings in that Vince and the rest of the office made up. You know, and you'd see what town you were in. You'd write it down. I used to write down who I was working with so I knew, you know, what I was doing. So I look, and I'm in the garden. Okay, that's great. And I look, and it says Von Erich. And I'm saying to myself, oh, God damn. Is Fritz coming up here? You know,
sure.
Because I know I'm not putting Fritz over any place anymore.
Right.
We're done. Yeah. You know, I never thought he was that hot a worker anyway. But anyway, so it's David Von Erich. Now, out of the whole crew, the David Von Erich was the best worker in the family. So Arnold Skolin, who was the agent in the garden, comes into the dressing room, and I'm sitting in there. Johnny Valiant was sitting next to me. I think Fuji was in there. Whoever else, you know, a few of us in the heel dressing room. Mm-hmm. And Skolin says, Davey, you're on fourth. He says, with the Von Erich kid, get about 12, 14, and get his hand up. And I went, nope. He says, what? I said, no. He says, no what? I said, I'm not putting him over. He said, what do you mean you're not putting him over? I said, hey, Arnold, I just got back from Texas. I said, I used to have to dream of the Von Erichs every night. I said, I'm in New York now. This is Madison Square Garden. I'm in my territory. He's visiting for one night. I said, and this is on closed circuit.
Yeah.
I said, I'm not putting him over. Jesus Christ. So he walks out. Who walks in next? Is Vince Sr.
Oh.
And he says, Davey, I can't believe what I'm hearing. He says, we treat you like family. And I'm saying to myself, yeah, well, if this is how you treat family, well, there's a goddamn problem here. But so I said, hey, Mr. McMahon, listen, I don't know if this is politics because his father's a promoter. My father's not a promoter. I said, he comes up here to New York, and you want his hand up in Madison Square Garden. That's big. I said, incidentally, I already knew the answer to this one. I said, are you paying me the same thing you're paying him? Mm-hmm. I knew he was getting $500 more than I was.
Mm-hmm.
He says, well, if it's the money, I said, that's one of them. He whips out $500 more and hands it to me. I said, did you pay his trans to get here from Texas? He says, well, you know we did. I said, well, you didn't pay my trans to get here from New Jersey. I said, the New Jersey Turnpike is 80 cents each way. That's $1.60. I said, and the Lincoln Tunnel is $1. That's $2.60. And he says, I can't believe what I'm hearing. He says, well, you're just going to have to do this. So I started unlacing the pink boots and said, no, I'm not going to have to do this. I don't have to do this at all. Jesus Christ. So he hands me another $5 bill.
Uh-huh.
And I said, I'll go get you the change. I don't want the change. So he's really mad now.
Yeah.
So I said, I'll tell you what, I'll get him over, but it's got to be my finish. It's got to be what I say to do. So, you know, I worked something out. You know, that the finish where, you know, I have him in a full Nelson. He puts his feet up on a turnbuckle, pushes back. We're both on the mat with our shoulders, but he's on top. One, two, three. Mm-hmm. You know, so that was that. The really, really dumb move that I made was I didn't realize that David Von Erich was getting a big push for the NWA title.
Sure.
And if he had a really good match in the garden with me, then he might have been saying, oh, let's bring him here or bring him there and let's work again.
Yeah.
But word went out that I did that. And you know, some of the boys, Johnny Valiant said, holy shit. He says, I wanted to crawl under the table. I never saw somebody do that. You know? So
yeah.
I said, well, and you know what? I always had a union card in the newspaper driver's union in New York and New Jersey. Uh-huh. So that's why I could be a little chesty about that. But that was a really big mistake.
Yeah.
That was a really big mistake because when you think about it, you know, it doesn't matter whose hand gets up. It doesn't matter. Mm-hmm.
Sure.
You know, it matters the product that you give the people.
Yeah.
Right. You know, and if you represent yourself well enough, well, then you know, George Steele will tell you, and like I said, he and I got to be close personal friends. And somebody was complaining to him once, oh, they want me to do a job. George Steele says, when do you ever see me get my hand up except on television? He said, I'm the heel. I'm always getting beat unless it's a return program or something like that. He said, doesn't matter. And it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. You know, guys my age or in my era, you know, I see people use the word jobbers a lot. We never, ever referred to somebody as that.
Yeah.
Everybody in that dressing room was a professional wrestler. Now, there were guys in there that shouldn't have been in there, and we had ways to discourage them to not come back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the reason that was done was because if they were really bad or they weren't serious about it, they exposed our business.
Right.
And back then, we protected it. We protected it 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
You know, and all different guys had different answers to, nah, isn't that stuff all fake? Well, my answer was, well, you know, don't mistake what you see on television with what you'd see right here. But if you think I'm fake, there's one way you can find out right now, and it'll only take about 30 seconds. And I can convince you. I can convince you that I'm not fake.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that, the jobber thing, right? That like jobber enhancement, carpenter, whatever you want to call it. That has had such a negative for fans.
Oh my god!
Such a negative connotation, right? They see, oh well, these guys are quote unquote losing all the time. They're this, but
well, I see them.
If a guy is in a position and he shows up,
I read about that, talking about guys like Mike Cicluna. Oh my god!
Yeah, but Mike, if a guy Cicluna, shows up,
he was a big star. He sold out the Old Garden with Bruno.
Yeah. But I mean, jobber? Again, if a guy shows up and he sees his name right on the sheet with, you know, Davey O'Hannon, and he goes, all right, I'm going to get a good match. He's good. Davey's going to make me look good. And well, that's what was important, right?
Yes, I hope so. I mean, I told newer guys that came in, there was a guy, and I'll use his name because he's a nice guy. He was a local guy down in South Jersey. Gino. Mm-hmm. Gorilla Monsoon was sort of friendly with him and would use him on the local shows to fill in. His name was Stan Lovdus.
Okay.
I think he worked in a diner down South Jersey, but he was a nice man.
Mm-hmm.
So I go to the arena one night, one of the South Jersey shows, and I'm working with Stan Lovdus. Now, I know that I'm not going to have as much fun because I can't do as much with Stan that I can with like a Manny Soto or a Pete Sanchez or something. I just can't do that stuff with him.
Sure.
You know, he's not a skilled guy in a ring. And he says to me, Gino says, Davey, no more than 2 minutes for this guy. Get your hand up. I said, oh, Gino. I said, he just came over to me and told me his wife and kids and a lot of his friends are here. And Gino says, I don't care. This is not a game for them. I said, Gino, could you give me 10 minutes and just let me handle it? So he says, yeah, I will. He says, and if you don't handle it right, you and I are going to have a problem. Okay, well, let's see. Let me get my list out of guys. I don't want to have a problem with Monsoon's one of them.
Sure.
Right? I said, yeah. Oh, brother. So,
you're right.
So I took Stan Lovdes on a side. I said, listen, you are going to have the best match you ever had in your life tonight.
Yeah.
If you listen to me, if you listen to me, so all you got to do is listen. I said, let me see you throw a punch. Oh, it was terrible. I said, listen, there's a big stomach and chest in front of you. I want you to throw a punch to my stomach right now and do it like you mean it. I said, but if you don't hit me, I'm going to drill you. I'm going to hit you back so hard that you're not going to know what happened. Oh, okay, yeah. Okay. Boom, boom. So I actually taught him how to throw a few punches. I said,
yeah.
See that? I said, so here's what we're going to do. They're going to give us instructions. You go out first, sign some autographs, wave to your kids, and do all of that stuff. I said, let me come out and get these people pissed off at me. All right, I had pink tights, pink boots, a pink sequin jacket. I said, as soon as I walk out there, they don't like me. I said, so that's good. I said, let me get started here. I said, they're going to give us instructions. While they're talking, while they're giving instructions, I'm going to get the crowd a little more going. When we're done hearing Dick Worley give us instructions, and I said, now listen to Dick, because he's going to tell you what's going on in this match. I said, turn your back on me. Start walking to your corner to take your jacket off. I said, you'll feel me coming across the ring because I'll stomp. Mm-hmm. I said, as soon as I get to you, turn around, put your hands around my waist, put me in the corner, throw about five or six of those big punches I just showed you how to do. I said, the last one, put it right on my chin. Don't worry about if you hit me. Just hit me. Hit me. Take me, shoulder haul me across the ring. When I tell you, Dave, this place exploded.
Yeah.
Exploded. I still had my jacket on. I said to him, after that, I got close to him. I said, I'm going to be leaning back on the ropes. I said, clothesline, hit me with that forearm right across my chest. Boom. I went backwards over the top rope. The place was going nuts. And I got back in. I begged off for about 5 minutes. Okay, so now we got our time in. And I kept saying to him, get mad. Get pissed off. Say out loud, come here, you son of a bitch. I'm going to kill you. Who are you to do this? This is my town. And the people were eating it up. So he came, he dragged me in the ring by my hair twice. The third time he tried it, I hooked him over the neck backwards over the top rope, and I hung on, and I got disqualified. Okay, well, guess what? Stan Lovdes is still in the ring. All they remember is me flying around and him beating the crap out of me, and now they're holding his hand up. He just won.
Yep.
He just won. It was a good match. Gino says to me, well, who did you work with? That sounded okay. I said, yeah, don't worry. We did it. And he came to me later in tears. He said, my kids, he says, I never saw them like this. Okay. So that was worth my trip down to South Jersey. You know?
Yeah.
But see, New York put these guys in the ring that shouldn't have been there. And they exposed us, and I think that's where the jobber thing came, because the people saw it week in and week out and week in. And I'm not talking about Frankie Williams. You know, Frankie Williams was a special case.
Sure.
You know, he got beat up every week, but he always fought.
Yeah, yeah.
He always fought, you know, and there were some guys like that. But there were guys that went in that ring and didn't have any idea what they were doing.
Yep.
But, you know, they bought a pair of shoes and they bought tights and they called themselves professional wrestlers. Now, I don't watch any, and I don't go to some unless I'm going to an autograph thing. But I've seen some of the independents and I'm saying to myself, oh, my God, what's going on? Did anybody show these guys what to do? Well, the answer is no.
Nope.
Secondly, one of them some knight's going to get killed, unfortunately. There's no doubt about that. Somebody's breaking a neck or you know, something's going to happen. And they're doing such silly things in front of crowds of 25, 50, maybe 100 people.
Yes.
And they don't get paid.
Nope.
They set up the ring. They give them some hot dogs and soda, you know, and they're calling themselves professional wrestlers. Well, I resent that.
Yes.
I resent that. And the reason I do is I'm going through surgeries that you can't even believe, that I can't even believe. You know, I've had nine knee surgeries. I've had my Achilles tendon reconstructed. I just had every lumbar vertebrae and two sacrovertebrae fused. I'm talking to you now. I'm holding the phone in my right hand because I got a huge incision on my left hand and my left elbow from nerve damage. I got to get the other side done, but they just told me that skip that next hand and arm operation. You have to get your neck done or you're going to have a serious problem. So I have severe compression of all the cervical vertebrae and the nerves up there.
Yeah.
So somebody gets on there and says, well, I'm a professional wrestler. Oh, yeah? Oh, yeah, who'd you work for? Well, you know, I work the independents. Oh, all right. Mm-hmm. And that's fine. Terry Funk used to say, if you got the passion, brother, do it. But try to do it the right way. But that's all done now. That, you know, the protecting, you know, that they call the people smart marks now.
Yeah.
There were people in my family I didn't smarten up.
Right, yeah.
And that's the truth.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
So, the jobber stuff is disrespectful to a guy like Mike Cicluna or Dominic or any of them.
Yeah. Definitely. So let's talk. I got to ask you, because working in the Northeast, right, you had lots of encounters with Andre the Giant. And you can't get away from, you know, talking to someone without getting some Andre stories. So tell us an Andre story. First of all, let me lead you in, because I heard you tell a story about Andre and Pedro Morales.
Oh.
Do you know the story I'm referring to?
Yeah, I'm trying to think of the name of the hotel. The Lincoln Motor Inn in Reading.
Okay.
We used to do TV in Philadelphia at the old Philadelphia Arena. We'd finish up, and we would have to work in Hamburg, Pennsylvania the next night.
Mm-hmm.
Halfway there was the Lincoln Motor Inn in Reading, where everybody stayed.
Okay.
Now, Andre could put away a few drinks.
Sure. No exaggerations on those stories, right?
There is no exaggeration. You can't even believe it. And Pedro was no slouch on the partying either.
All right, okay.
Pedro lived in the same town I lived. We were sort of neighbors up in, I'm down by the Jersey Shore now, but up north Jersey, so Pedro lived not far away. You know, if you bumped into Pedro in the shop, right, he'd say, oh, baby, let's go for lunch, and you knew if it was noon, you weren't getting home till 8 o'clock at night. So, you know, you had to duck into another aisle if Pedro was there. So Andre is so blasted after drinking all night. He's walking through the lobby of the Lincoln Motor Inn. I was sitting on a couch off to the side. I don't know who else was there, but we were sitting on a couch. And there were two steps that went up, real long steps, the width of the room, to go up to the desk. So Andre's going up to get his key, he and Skoland. And you know, Pedro was somewhere down there. Anyway, so Andre steps up one step, steps down backwards off the step, tries for two, no, does no good. And when he gets up to the second step, he starts to do a full back bump off the step. And there were folding tables there that he fell on, and he flattened them. Crash! Bang! I mean, It was unbelievable. So a bunch of us got up, and we're going to help him up. And Pedro says, well, he's got the room right across from me, baby. I'll get him from here. So we get them in the elevator, and they get up there, and Pedro's under Andre's arm, and they're walking. And they get to Andre's room, and they're fumbling with the key. The door opens up, and they fall into the room. Okay. And Andre is fallen on top of Pedro. Okay. All 450 pounds of them, unconscious.
Yeah.
Now, Pedro can't get up. Luckily, on the baseboard was the wire for the phone. And Pedro ripped it off the baseboard and dragged the phone off the nightstand to him and dialed the operator and said, send somebody up here. Send the boys up here to help. I can't get up. And that's what it was. Andre was on, and when we went up there, he was still unconscious.
Yeah.
Pedro was starting to have trouble breathing because of the way he landed on him. He's hollering, he's screaming. Oh, man, it was unreal. It was unreal.
Yeah. Yeah, and then, I mean, yeah, you told, right? You said that, I believe I heard the story one time, Andre, what was it, hanging you on a fence or something by your jeans or something?
Yeah,
or?
We used to stay in Amarillo. We stayed at a place called the Center City Motor Inn. And so there was a bar across the street. We could get some food. We'd go there to drink. And Andre was in for the week, to go around to all the towns with us. So of course we go across the street and we're eating and drinking and it's time to leave. And there's a construction site, right next to the bar, and they got a cyclone fence put up. And it wasn't a 10-foot fence. You know, it was just a 6, whatever size cyclone fence is, but they got those sharp little crosses up on top. Yep. And we're walking out, and he says, hey, boss. And I wasn't paying attention. And he snatched me. I had a pair of jeans on. He snatched me, and he hung my ass on the fence. And it caught the back pocket of my jeans, and it didn't rip. It just ripped through. But it didn't tear. Oh. And the fence was leaning forward, but not forward enough for me to touch the ground. And Andre used to laugh. Like Santa Claus. I said, where are you going? So my partner was a guy named Dennis Stamp. I said, hey, Dennis. I said, come back over here. Oh, fuck you, pal. He said, no, I'm sorry. I said, fuck.
He said,
no. He says, Andre, put you there. Let Andre take you off. Holy shit. Well, when is this going to happen? I don't know if somebody called the police, the cops all knew the guys, and they helped me off the fence. Next day, I said to him, you big son of a bitch. I said, if I didn't think you would just get pissed at me, I'd shoot you. So he was laughing. He was laughing. He thought it was funny.
Yeah. So what ultimately, around 82-ish, you kind of wrapped up in New York. What led to you kind of leaving the Northeast there and leaving New York?
I'm sorry. Did I leave New York?
Well, I don't know. Did they phase you out a little bit because of that? It was changing to Vince Jr. Bit there.
No, you know what? My body was starting to wear out, and I could be a little more picky with independents or other promoters, and since I had a good relationship with somebody like Bruno. He could make a call for me. I always wanted to work in St. Louis. For Sam Muchnick.
Yeah.
So Bruno said, well, why don't you tell me? I said, well, I didn't think of that. That's why I didn't tell you.
Yeah.
I didn't think of it. So I went and he'd send me out there. I don't know what year it was. I went back to Japan because that was always a good trip.
Yeah, I think it was around 82. But this time you went for New Japan.
Yes.
Right? And Oroonoke. So tell us about that. And what What were the differences between working All Japan and New Japan? Did you notice any differences?
Well, you know, I worked with Inoki. Inoki had more of an ego than Baba did.
Okay, yeah.
You know, I won't say that Baba wasn't serious about it, but, you know, Baba was more Americanized, I guess it is.
Okay.
With the wrestling.
Yeah.
Inoki, you know, you have to understand the culture there. You know, we were working in front of their people.
Mm-hmm.
So nothing could be disrespectful. I mean, you did your heel stuff. You know, you did your heel stuff. And you know, I worked with Inoki several times there. And, you know, I didn't hold back. And, you know, by then I was a little more of a confident worker. You know, I knew how to stop somebody from taking advantage of me. You know, I didn't oversell things that I didn't think I should. I think that might have been the trip that I was tagging with Hogan and Iron Sheik and Morocco and myself. You know, a whole bunch of us were there doing that. So when you worked with Inoki, you always had to keep in mind, again, like when you work with Baba, okay, this is the owner, man.
This yeah, right.
Make him look good. So if you sold like crazy for Inoki, his stuff, he sold for you, but for him, the comeback was the big thing. And that's the big thing with all baby faces. That's what gets them over.
Yeah,
that's
of
what
course.
Get them over. You know, I would tell new guys, listen, I'm, you know, I'm a jabroni, but I'm going to tell you what a really good philosophy for a heel is. I was never a baby face. I'll tell you a good philosophy for a heel. You got to be sneaky. You got to be vicious. And you have to be a coward.
Okay.
If you're sneaky, you get to jump on a baby face. Once you do, then you got to be vicious. And that's going to make those people hate you. There's nothing worse than a sneaky 250-pound athlete that eventually is going to be a coward.
Yeah.
And that worked. So that's the kind of stuff you did over there. The newer kids that were, I'm sorry. See that? That's my incision. I was moving it to get comfortable.
Oh, that's okay.
You know, the guys, when I got there, I am pretty sure that was the year that the United States boycotted the Olympics. And a lot of our allies followed for whatever reason. I just don't recall what it was for. They boycotted the Olympics. So a lot of the wrestlers that were going to go to the Olympics couldn't go. Okay.
Yeah, right.
Let's see, who should we blame? Let's blame the United States, because that's who started this. So they were working for Inoki, and that made things different for us, because the baby faces really hated us. You know, and I had a problem the very first night. I had a problem that it was a six-man tag. It was myself, Hogan, and Khosro, the Iron Sheik.
Sure.
I started the match, and, you know, I didn't know these guys. I didn't know, you know, I knew some of the top guys. I knew Inoki and him. But so I opened up my body, and this guy gave me a kick in the nuts that you can't even believe.
Oh.
You can't even believe. I almost got sick right in the middle of the ring. Down I went. Oh. I heard Hogan say, "Oh God, tag off," and I rolled to the corner. I was all curled up. I was on the mat. I put my hand up. Hogan took the tag, and Hogan, I rolled under the rope. I was still on the apron, kind of in a fetal position, and Hogan brought him over to the corner and pounded him like he was a cheap steak, man. He hit him so many times, so hard. And then I heard my friend Khosro say, And he also, I don't know if you ever heard Yarn Sheik talk, rest his soul.
Yeah, of course, hey, yeah.
Davey, this receipt for you right now, my friend. And I went, what? And Iron Sheik went in, turned this kid over onto his back, posted his head, which means you put your hand up under his chin and push. And if the head stays there, the rest of the body can't go anywhere.
Yeah.
And he popped his eye, he plucked his eye.
Oh.
Popped it right out.
Oh.
And I'm going, oh, holy, I never saw something like that before. I heard you could do that. Well, there
yeah.
it is.
Yeah.
He said, that for you. That's for you, Davey. Oh, my God. I might have just asked you to kick the shit out of him. I'm not sure I wanted you to take his eye, but okay. You know, who am I to argue? So he plucked his eye. But I have to say that the next 5 weeks were really easy. The next five weeks were a breeze.
Sure.
Unreal. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So when you went over there, and it was the reason I asked Bruno originally, am I able to handle this? You know, I knew how to wrestle, but I didn't know if I was good enough to do that. You had to work a little harder because they work what we call closer or snug.
Mm-hmm. Snug, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, and if it's going to be a forearm, you better lay it in. Mm-hmm. You better lay it in. You know, I was never a big fan of chops. Okay, do one. It gets the fans' attention. Don't be like Rick. Don't be like Rick and do 25 of them. It doesn't matter anymore.
Doesn't matter
anymore. You know, one pop, the people hear it. Okay, oh, my God, you see that? Yes, but that's it. You know, that's it. So you had to work a little harder. You had a contract. You know, it was like a personal service contract. You had to really mind your P's and Q's. You know, I was never big on being disrespectful to waitresses or waiters or any of that stuff. You know, I'm still a please and thank you kind of guy. So, you know, some of the wrestlers, you know, thought the world owed them a living. And, you know, they wouldn't act the way a nice person would act. That's why I really was picky about who I hung out with.
Sure.
You know, I would have liked to have been a little more of a party guy, but I was surrounded by Bruno, Dominic DiNucci, Mike Cicluna, Manny Soto, you know, Johnny Rods, you know.
Yeah.
These guys were, you know, we went to work. That was our job, wrestling.
Yep.
We didn't go to have a party. You know, you'll hear the new guy say, oh, tell me about all the jokes and the ribs and stuff when you were traveling. Let me tell you something. Yeah, there were guys that used to joke around and do things like that. And some of it was fun, but you got to understand something. We were at work.
Yeah.
We were at work. We got in a car and did 500 miles after a match. I wasn't going home that night. You know, the newer guys will say, well, you know, we were on the road. Well, you were on a road. You made a 60-mile trip every 2 months. That's not on the road. You know?
Yeah, right.
You know, so you know, I had a really good group of people around me. I had a really good, you know, Gino Monsoon, again, you know, I was a pallbearer for him. You know, he was the most generous guy you ever met in your life.
Yeah,
he was unbelievable. He was a good person, but I'm telling you, he was a real live badass if he had to be.
Yeah.
Oh, brother.
One thing I like to ask people, because I grew up, I was born and raised in Indiana. I don't live there now, but I lived the majority of my life in Indiana.
Okay.
Which, of course, in Indiana, it's Dick the Bruiser, right? That was our territory.
Yep.
That was our guy. Did you ever have any encounters with Dick the Bruiser over your travels?
I met him, and, you know, I got to know him through Bruno because they were partners.
That
WWA thing.
Yep.
So I came, you know, I worked with for them a couple of times. But before I was in the business, when I was in college, before I got smartened up, Dick the Bruiser was working in the Kansas City Memorial Auditorium one night.
Sure.
I was there watching.
Yeah.
I think he was working with Pat O'Connor.
Okay.
I think he was working. Now, Pat O'Connor was a legend in the business. And
sure.
I watched him as a kid.
Yeah.
Now, I may be wrong about who Bruiser was working with, but I had never seen the Bruiser in person. And they did some kind of hot finish, and people were getting close to the ring. And I said, well, I guess I should do that. And I started to put my foot up on the steps. Bruiser was half in and half out of the ring at the apron at the top of the steps. And he turned around and looked at me. Holy crap. I said, whoa. I couldn't have got back to my seat any faster. Holy. I mean, he was an impressive looking guy. He
sure.
was an impressive looking guy. And yeah. when I got to know him, I told him what happened. You know, he didn't remember it, of course, because, you know,
right.
that happened to
yeah.
him all the time.
All the time, yeah.
yeah, it happened to him all the time. But he said, kid, no, that's a bad idea. Bad idea, you know. yeah, now I know it's a bad idea.
Sure, you know? Yeah.
So, you know, because you can't let a fan, you know, in the ring, if you haven't been in a ring, that's our little world.
That's and right.
It feels different when you get up there. So if you're a civilian and you climb through those ropes, it's a little bit intimidating.
Yeah.
It's
right.
a little bit intimidating. And
yeah.
if I'm already in the ring and you're halfway in the ring, I'm going to pull you the rest of the way in. And you're
yeah.
really not going to like what happens.
Yep, that's right.
You're really not going to like what happens. You know, it's going to be because... You know, you could be a street fighter, but you're not in the street, man.
That's
right. You're right here. You're right here.
Yeah.
And so Bruiser said, oh, that's a bad idea. Well, no shit. You know.
Well, tell me now, you got the advised on the Bruno book. What's the future hold? Is there any chance we'll see any future writings for you?
Well,
future activity? What's the future hold for Davey O'Hannon?
Yeah, a lot of people have said to me, you really need to think about doing a book. Well, you know what? I'm not sure I'm eloquent enough to even get started with that. I wouldn't know how to start, although a few people have said to me, we'll help.
Mm-hmm.
We'll help.
Yeah.
It's, you know, I think my story's a little tiny bit different. Just a little tiny bit different because I never got broken into the business except on the job.
Yeah.
Town after town after town, I learned something every single night. And, you know, and I learned how to be respectful, you know, and there were the underneath guys. You know, I worked with Arnold Skolin. I worked with Mike Padusis. You know, I worked with Strongbow. I worked with all of these guys.
You've worked with everybody.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I got to work with all of these guys. And, you know, when I was in the car with the old timers, I'd ask them a million questions. Hey, did you know so-and-so? Did you wrestle? You know, and the old guys like to talk about that. I mean, I worked with Haystacks Calhoun. You know, I worked with Bobo Brazil. I mean, all of these guys that I watched as a kid.
Yeah.
That I watched as a kid. I became very friendly with Freddie Blassie. I watched Freddie. I hated him. And he remembered something. He said, oh, you were that little son of a bitch in the Roosevelt Stadium, right? I said, yeah, that was me. That was me saying that stuff to you. You know, and I actually, when Freddie first came back to the WWWF, he was wrestling.
Right.
So I wrestled him on TV.
Oh.
I wrestled him. So for me to be able to say to myself, wow, I was in the ring with Fred Blassie.
Sure.
That's a big deal. I was in the ring with Lou Thesz.
Yeah.
You know, Danny Hodge.
Danny Hodge, yeah.
I mean, so these guys, you know, I work with both Funks. I work with Terry and I work with Dory.
Yeah.
you know, so getting to do all of this stuff, you know, I don't know, you know, a lot of people were kind of born into the business, and, you know, other people went to wrestling schools and you know, had things happen for them. I didn't have that, and, you know, I think I did okay in the business.
Sure, you know, of course.
I don't think I embarrassed myself. No. I got to work in the garden. You know, I worked in a whole lot of big arenas all over the country. I worked with Ray Stevens. Oh, my God. Nobody better.
Nope.
Nobody right. better. Terry Funk. Terry Funk, probably one of the best ever this business is going to see.
Sure. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Bobby Heenan. Now, I didn't work in the ring with Bobby, but we were friendly. Bobby was a superstar, a legend.
Yep. Bobby's my hero, right?
Yeah.
Because, again, Indiana boy there, right? That's my
yes,
hero.
Yes. Yes. You know, Ernie Roth, the Wiz. Ernie Roth. He used to say to me, "Well, you Irish son of a bitch, you." You know, but he was great. He was great, and I worked with Pat Patterson. Patterson was a master in the ring, a master.
Yep.
And you know, so I got to work with so many of these guys, and you know, somebody will ask me to tell them a story. And I'll say to them at the end, dreams do come true.
Yeah.
Dreams do come true. You know, so.
Well, again, yeah, I mean, you were a fan of pro wrestling who pretty much just kind of forced your way into it, right? You weren't going to be told no.
You're exactly right. I forced my way in.
Yeah.
I forced my way in. And
yeah.
there were kids that I was in grammar school with. We had a class reunion a couple of years ago for high school. And I heard somebody say, "He always said he was going to do that." He always said he was going to do that. And, you know, lucky me. You know, lucky me.
Lucky the Irish, right?
Yeah. You know, I have regrets because of the shape my body's in. You know, it's just my body is just wrecked. And the reason it's wrecked is because I provided the exact same product for the fans, whether it was Madison Square Garden, the Marigold Arena, or any little place out of the way. They got the exact same match for me. I took the bumps because I always said those people bought tickets just like the people in the garden did.
That's right.
And they need to have their experience. So,
that's right.
You know, that's what I did. I did just this past weekend. I went over to a autograph convention. I wasn't booked for it, but Slaughter was there. The Demolition, Bill Eady and Barry Darsaw. Luke.
Yeah,
Luke the Bushwhacker. Yeah. I mean, Chief, I still call him a sheep herder, but Luke was there. And Ray Apollo, who's Doink the Clown, who's a close friend.
Sure.
So you know, I kind of went in there, and I have to use a walker to walk, because of the back operation and the nerve damage has really done a number on me. But you know, I walked over. Slaughter saw me coming, and he went, "Oh, I told you too many bumps. I told you too many bumps." You know?
Yeah.
And Bill Eady, who was Demolition.
Smash.
You know, he and I did a Japan tour together. And and he said, "Oh, brother," he said, "I told you a long time ago, you know, you don't have to do all of that stuff." Yeah, I know. the sad part was there was a wrestling show, which I didn't stay for, after the autograph signing.
Mm-hmm.
And Luke, at 80 years old, was getting in the ring.
Yeah. Oh yeah. You see plenty of that.
That's sad.
It is.
That's sad. So many of these guys had nothing to fall back on.
That's right. Yeah.
And promoters could turn your water off whenever they felt like it.
Yeah. Right.
Whenever they felt like it. And I used to hear Dominic and Mike Cicluna, Manny Soto, Pete Sanchez, SD Jones. I'd hear these guys talk about it. Well, you know, luckily I was also a union official in the newspaper union. Mm-hmm. And since we were all close friends, I made sure they, when they wanted to stop wrestling, they walked into really lucrative jobs with benefits and vacations and all kinds of stuff. So, you know, that made me feel good too, because I was able to do that. You know, I used to say to Mike Cicluna, you do know that I hated your guts, right? You know, Mike finished up working for the New York Times. You know, as did DiNucci. You know, and the other guys were in different places, different papers, different companies, and they got that. But a guy like Luke, at 80 years old, now when I went to say hello to him, he said, "Well, Jesus, mate," he says, "Where did I see you last? Pensacola?" I said, "Oh, might have been. I don't remember. Yeah, just a couple of months ago." Uh oh. Yeah,
he's a little not longer.
Doing. Yeah, you know. He's about ready to hide his own Easter eggs. I mean, Jesus. So, there's the good and bad with it, but, I don't know how the business is now. It had its seedy side. Yeah, it had its seedy side when we were there. But, you know, guys like Bruno and them, they made it respectful and respectable.
Of course. Yeah. Well, Davey, I hope I would love to see you hook up with someone and do a book, because again, you and I have talked for an hour and a half plus.
Wow, I'm sorry. My wife says you ramble on. Don't bore this guy to death.
That's okay, and I can listen forever. But again, my point being, we just scraped the surface. I mean, there was so much more, right, that you could tell and talk about, and so many stories you could have. I'm a book guy, so I'd love to see you do a book sometime and. No pressure, but, you know, okay. I'd love to see that. I love books.
Thank you for that. Yeah, I read all the wrestling books that go out. Well, thank you for saying that. And you know, I'm flattered and humbled that you would even consider listening to me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, and I hope, again, like I said, we've talked this time, and there's so much more. So I hope maybe down the road we can do a part two, tell some more stories and talk some more, because there's – I think you got a lot more stories to talk about. I'd love to talk more.
Well, I will. We'll look forward to doing that. And
I do.
It'd be my pleasure, Dave.
Well, I appreciate that, Davey. And again, have a good night. Rest of your week. And I appreciate you giving me your time and telling me some stories. And look forward to talking to you again.
Anytime, my friend. I'll look forward to it also. Take care.
Available on all streaming platforms. It's professional wrestling's greatest, largest, privately owned wrestling library. All the classic hits, flips, slams, and pins of yesteryear are on one place. It's Ultimate Classic Wrestling. Check out the Nature Boy Ric Flair, Hulk Hogan, Mr. USA Tony Atlas, Tito Santana, Rick Martel, a who's who of professional wrestling's greatest spotlight stars ever to grace the squared circle, all in one place. Grab the best seat in the house for memories and mayhem on Ultimate Classic Wrestling.
Hey guys, Ray Russell here. Lots of new stuff happening here at WrestleCopia. If you haven't checked out our website at WrestleCopia.com, it's a great way to keep up with the latest episodes of all of your favorite Copia programming, from the Wrestling Memory Grenade to Regional Wrestling with the Territory Talk, the Wrestling Stoop with the legendary Bob Roop, and of course all of those programs also available at your favorite podcast streaming platforms. And if you want to stay up to date with everything going on in the Copia world, all the latest news, random thoughts, fun videos, pictures, and more, make sure to join the more than 33,000 followers over at facebook.com/wrestlinggrenade. Don't be left out. And last, but definitely not least, it's what keeps the entire machine going. I'm talking about patreon.com/wrestlecopia. We appreciate your support in helping us pay the bills to keep the WrestleCopia Podcast Network running and enabling us to continue to bring you all the quality programming that we offer.
All right, and thank you to Davey for coming on and speaking with me. Guys, follow me on social media. I'm on pretty much any platform. Just look for Nostalgic Dave Dynasty, and you can find me. Also, be sure to subscribe to me on YouTube for lots of classic wrestling content, plus all of my other various podcasts. And be sure that whatever platform you listen to this podcast on, make sure you subscribe, rate, and review. Go check out all the other WrestleCopia Network podcasts. You can find the individual shows on your favorite podcast platforms, or you can visit WrestleCopia.com. And also, while you're out there, be sure to check out my friends at the Ultimate Classic Wrestling Library. Visit ClassicWrestling.net to sign up for your account, and then download the Ultimate Classic Wrestling app on all of your smart devices. Thank you once again, guys, for joining me for yet another episode. Thank you once again to Davey O'Hannon for granting me the interview. And guys, until next episode, remember, wherever you go and whatever you do, be good, be safe, and always keep on growing.
Fans, we brought you All-Star Championship Wrestling. This is Sam Manager thanking you for being with us and saying until next time, so long, everyone.